Namaste friends, Suswagatam and welcome to our Sunday edition of Gyan Ganga Words of Wisdom on our Virat Hindustan Sangam various social media channels. And today is our 190th episode 190, and today's topic is, has the time arrived for ideology of the modern right? And Dr. Subramaniam Swamy will be speaking on this book he has written and on the topic for the next 40 to 45 minutes, and we will be discussing this issue. As you all know, we are watched across 121 countries across the globe every Sunday for this important program, which, as I mentioned, is on various social media channels of YouTube, Spaces, on Facebook, Instagram, podcast, and etc. So we are on various channels catering to various people on various walks of life. We are also available on YouTube and all our past episodes, and Dr. Swamy's talks on various subjects are always available on YouTube in the Virat Hindustan Sangam Virat Hindustan Sangam's channel records. So you can go to YouTube and watch it. I have to thank my co-host Ramesh Swamy and Professor Arvind Chaturvedi from Delhi for hosting this program every Sunday. And I have to thank our technical team led by Ashish Shetty, Tejas Navalgul, Ishwar Iyer, Swami Nathan, Rakesh Gadgi, Vishal Mehta and Ajesh Nair for putting this background material together so that we have this program every Sunday at 8 p.m. So with these words, it's over to Dr. Swamy to initiate the discussion, has the time arrived for ideology of the modern right. Over to Dr. Swamy. Thank you.
Thank you, Jagdish. In 1947, when we became free of the British, there was a division that was caused by those sections of the Muslim community who didn't want to live with India, with Hindus in India, and they wanted a separate country, and the British obliged them, and the Congress party then, whatever, it was a different Congress party, but still it was a Congress party. They sort of buckled in and agreed to a partition. There were people who were against it. So the biggest opponent was Dr. Ambedkar. And then finally he said, if you are going to partition India, then make an exchange of population of Hindus on both sides coming to India and Muslims on both sides going to Pakistan. But of course, that was not accepted. And there was a division in which there was a Muslim Pakistan and a secular India. And in the course of the Constituent Assembly, when the constitution was being prepared, there were three key people who were responsible. I think Jawaharlal Nehru, for some reason, I think was too much interested in foreign affairs, and so he didn't have time, and he thought, he'd now become prime minister, I don't have to worry. But he was mistaken, because Rajendra Prasad was chosen as the president of the Constituent Assembly to make the constitution. Sardar Patel was made chairman of the Committee for Fundamental Rights, so to incorporate fundamental rights in the constitution. And Dr. Ambedkar was given the onerous task of moving all the amendments and, piloting the whole thing and finally getting an agreed constitutional draft. Because what had happened is the various parties had nominated their representatives, a very variety. So almost everybody was represented in the Constituent Assembly. And marvelous job Dr. Ambedkar did. Of course, he was a very educated man. He got his PhD in economics from Columbia University in 1916. Then he went to Britain and he got another PhD. It was called by some other title, but the London School of Economics gave me another PhD. And then he stayed on to become a lawyer. And when he came back to India, he was slowly dragged into politics. And he's written many books and so on. All this, unfortunately, because Jawaharlal Nehru had this deep jealousy about him, I think. He was pushed to a corner, and only after the Janata emerged on the scene in 1989, Dr. Ambedkar got his Bharat Ratna. He should have been honored much earlier. And Sardar Patel got it in 91 when I was a minister, and the file was Chandrasekhar asked me for suggestions, and I went through the files and was shocked to find Sardar Patel's name not there. So anyway, we corrected for that, and Sardar Patel got it. Now, these three, Rajendra Prasad, Sardar Patel, and Ambedkar, they are the three people who created the constitution. And it was this constitution with little pluses and minuses here. I mean, since little minuses here and there, is perhaps the best constitution I've seen of all the constitutions in the world. And it's a very bulky one also, almost 400 articles and so on, and a preamble, which is something that everybody should read. I have been of the view for many years, and especially after coming to Jansang, and at that time, Nanaji Deshmukh asked me whether I could read the constitution and tell him whether we need a new constitution. And after reading it and getting from him all the basic things that he wanted to include in the new constitution, I said it's already included in the present constitution. So only thing that's happened wrong, which I'll come back to a little later again, is that during the emergency, Mrs. Gandhi put in what is called as the preamble. The preamble is not part of the constitution, but it tells you the sentiment of the people of the country as to what they want the constitution to represent. So it's in the very beginning, it is put there, and all the articles of the constitution start after it. So in the preamble, which you can't amend under any circumstance, because it's the voice of the people at that particular time, there was no reference to socialism and secularism. And Mrs. Gandhi got it included. And I have a petition pending in the Supreme Court, which could come any time. A lot of people are nervous that indeed I will make out a case, because there was no power under the constitution to amend the preamble. The preamble cannot be amended. And it just has a fixed date and so on. So that whole thing was a fraud. And so that apart, otherwise, if you read the constitution, I read the preamble, you'll see that the sentiments that we have in sophisticated way represent what we call as Hindutva. And I would like to make this point over and over again, that Hindutva is not Hinduism. It is the Hindu values. And these values include, let 100, like Mao Zedong used to say, let 100 flowers bloom. All kinds of ideas, so many variations, so many gods, so many areas. There's just not one god like in other religions. Son of God. So democratic spirit is actually Hinduism, and we may not have called it Hinduism, but we have called India in the Hindi version as Bharat. And Bharat is the name of a king who actually showed that you can choose somebody as a king, not necessarily the son or the daughter of the king, but somebody whom he thought was capable, and he did it. He rejected all his son's claim to be a king, and that's why we name him after they name the country after him. At least the constitutional name of the country is Bharat. Of course, our cultural name is Hindustan, and the word Hindu has been a lot of propaganda. which after researching, I find it is just nothing but rotten propaganda. That Hindu was actually the word Sindhu, and Arabs couldn't pronounce sir, so they pronounced it as a Hindu, Sindhu as a Hindu. And this has been going on and on and on and on. I'm thankful now, finally, after almost 10 years, the BJP government has brought out a draft of a history book that will be prescribed for schools. They're long overdue, but anyway, better late than never. So what I would say is the word Hindu, I'm producing in my new book, which is coming after this, and that book will be called Vishwa Guru. Can India be Vishwa Guru again? Because India was Vishwa Guru. Vishwa Guru is not a name of an individual. It is a name of a country. And India can be, and all the markers for it I've put out and showed that India easily can be that. So we have our country. The British wanted to destroy our identity. So they kicked up this Aryan and Dravidian. There is no such thing as an Aryan. Arya is only one word which comes to explain for everybody in India who behaves in a polished, civilized way. And Dravida is a name which was actually invented, if I may say so, by Adi Shankara when he went around the country converting everybody who wanted to debate with him. Through the debate, which is called Shastrat, he converted them. And so finally, from Kerala, he went all the way, he reached Bihar. And there, the greatest exponent, Mandana Mishra, was there. And he confronted him and said, let's have a debate. I lose, I become Buddhist. You lose, you become Hindu. And of course, Mandana Mishra lost and became Hindu. And he was the first Shringeri Shankaracharya, anointed by Adi Shankara. So, but when Adi Shankara went into that, Mandana Mishra had a very, very bright wife, who was very knowledgeable and all. So there was a question, who will be the umpire? So Adi Shankara himself said, after the two of us, there's only one person who can equal us, and that is your wife. So let her be the umpire. And she umpired the debate and declared her husband as loser. So that's how objective she was. But she asked the first question, who are you? He said, I'm a Dravida Shishu. So he was asked to explain, what is this word Dravida? So he said, of course, Shishu means child, and I'm the child. And Dravida is a sandhi of two words, thra and vid, which means where the three, thra is three, three and the coasts meet. And that is South India. So the word Dravid was never a racial thing. This is only the British cooked it up. It was a region. And Arya was a person that could be from north, south, east, west, as long as he's culturally, a proficient person. So I'm saying that even a simple thing like what's your identity, they say even on Hindu, There's so much confusion has been caused by British and the Jawaharlal Nehru's mistake of continuing this Ravishi history, which thank God the BJP came to power in absolute majority, and that we at least began the process, not as fast as I would like it to be, but it has begun. Now we've reached the stage where the books are ready and they have to be cleared, maybe even submitted to Parliament for a discussion. So the true history comes out, and what does it come out? That we are a very ancient country. Everybody says, no, you see, we were 300 BC because Alexander came, and he was the first one to see. Well, Alexander never came to India. He sent his representative, and he was defeated, and he himself was defeated. And he went on the way, I think, in Persia, I think, or someplace beyond that. He died out of sheer heartbroken heart because he had been winning everywhere, but he was defeated in India. There's no porous, all made up. So what is my source? So I have to put that in and tell people to create confidence. The source is that all dates in the history of India for thousands and thousands of years was based on the position of the stars and the planets. And the who recorded that? The Puranas, and especially Vishnu Purana and these Purana. There's another Purana which deals only with dates. They tell you the exact dates. How do I know that Mahabharata war was fought on the 3000 in 21 or something like that, February? The date, everything is given, those 18 dates of the war, all are given in the Puranas. And the Puranas mention the star position, particularly the star positions and the planet positions. And then from that, mathematically, they derive what is the date. So therefore, I don't think there's any difficulty in giving out, bringing out a genuine, genuine history book based on dates. The next thing I want to say is there have been 45 cultures which in the world, and they've all out of except one, and I'll tell you which one later, but you can guess. All the other 44 have disappeared, whether it's Mesopotamia, whether it was the pharaohs in Egypt. You take all these great cultures that were there, they all disappeared. They were there for some time, and then they became corrupt and disappeared. India is the only one which has a continuous Hindu civilization and unbroken. It may have had problems because of these invasions that took place, which made us poor also, and then also go into hiding. So therefore, this is one great point which we have to say, that we are a continuous civilization. To call India Hindustan is in cultural terms perfectly acceptable, and you'll be surprised that even Muslims use the word Hindustan. There was a great poet who later on went over to Pakistan, who said, "Sare jahan se acha Hindustan hamara," which is sung even today by our army when they play the band. They have this band ceremony functions. So what I'm saying is that the idea of becoming a Vishwaguru is by first becoming a modern society, a modern Hindu society, or what I called as a modern right. Why? Because right is the only one that will fit the Indian constitution. If you bring a left, I mean right and left, I mean right wing and left wing. Broadly speaking, right means freedom to express opinions, democratic society, so on, so forth. You know, all the things that we have, some of it not in truncated form, but we have it, and we have elections. We have defeated people who people thought will never be able to be defeated, like Indira Gandhi after the emergency. So I would say that India has to move right. It had moved left after 1947, and it was because of Jawaharlal Nehru. There were others also who were a little confused about the fact that the Soviet Union was doing so well, but later on people found out that it was all hollow, and today there's no Soviet Union also. And then if you compare Soviet societies with democratic societies like East Germany and West Germany, of course now they've become one, but if you compare East Germany and West Germany, East Germany was Soviet. I mean, it was socialism and communism. State ownership of all means of production, and West Germany was a democratic and market economy. And West Germany is far ahead. Even today, if you go to the United Germany, you'll find East Germany is so much poorer by comparison. Same thing with North Korea and South Korea. South Korea took to democracy and not only democracy but also to market economy. And even China, which is not a democracy, but they switched to market economy. So we need this right. India should be in the right. It should be in the right corner. and the right corner requires democracy, and with democracy, market economy. If these two are there, that is required. So when you push India towards a market economy, the state takeover is all limited to a very small amount, and only for certain emergencies. But by and large, allowing people to do their thing, if their taxation system, it should be a reasonable one. So these are things which will be one of my chapters in the new book, what the economy should be when we are a Vishwa Guru. And we want to influence the whole world. And so then we'll have to see that the products we produce are world class. So what I'm saying today is that we have come out of this socialism madness, this craze for, even today there's some craze for Russia because they think it is the same Russia which is called Soviet Union. That was so much more bigger. In fact, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union. Today's Russia and today's Ukraine, there were two states of the Soviet Union. And then they all broke into 16 pieces in 1991 or 92. So, we are the examples of Soviet Union and China, because China today, the Americans helped them a lot to get, once they brought their economy into a capitalistic mode, they allowed their markets, American, Europeans, they've opened their markets for the Chinese and the Chinese prospered. But today you find China is beginning to have problems, and that's why some of their aggression that is coming out against its neighbors is because of that. So India is a democratic country. India has a long tradition of democracy, you know, thousands and thousands of years. And in many, many aspects, Indian women were the freest of all. Even when we worship gods, the women gods are superior to the men gods. For example, when the Asuras had to be killed, all the male gods failed. And ultimately, they had to go to Durga and say, please save us. And after that, she took the Kali Roop and killed him. So, the issue, of course, the women and men, they had their different personalities. They are not identical. But within the framework of humanity and human rights, they had the same. There was no difference. It's only afterward the Islamic rules that the women had to be put in parda and away. And not to be seen in case somebody put eyes on them. So I am saying that here we can become very quickly, we can become a Vishwa Guru, provided first we become a modern right. And modern right means some of the things have to be given. Now, what are the things to be given in our religion, for example? In our religion, we have what is called as two parts to our religious granthas. You see, one is called Shruti and the other is called Smriti. So Shruti is what Vedas. Vedas are Shruti. Shruti, you see, means you can't amend it. It is God has given it to you. God has given it to these rishis who then wrote it up. Originally they were all oral. But over the years, they got to be written. So we have Vedas, and that is Vedas, Rig Veda, then Upanishads, so there are four Vedas. Vedas are divided into four parts. Then there are other aspects also. These are what we call as Shruti, which means you cannot amend them. So whatever was said then, whatever has been noted, that continues today. But there is another part which people don't realize, and that is called Smriti. Smriti means that these are made for the way of living and they can be amended. So Manu had a Smriti, and then after that Yajnavalkya came and said, no, that's out of date. So his Smriti, then Mitakshara, So now we can say the constitution of India is Smriti. So whatever the constitution says should be your behavior, should be adopted. So when I say modern, I'm not going to say you have to obey Manusmriti or something like that. I say you have to obey the constitution of India. And the constitution of India has all the things that Hindus would like it to be. And that's why I say that Sardar Patel, Rajendra Prasad, and Ambedkar, the three, and Ambedkar, by the way, was a great scholar of Hinduism. Jawaharlal Nehru made him bitter, and then he went to the other extreme. But otherwise, right from the day he was a student in Columbia, he was one of the most Hindu nationalists that you could think. And he was also highly educated. And it was a pity to see this Jawaharlal Nehru couldn't pass an examination being put in, you know, over his head. So anyway, those are things in the past. But I would say that the constitution has so many things which you will be surprised. And I made a note of it. For example, banning cow slaughter is not the madness of some Bajrang Dal people. It is in the constitution as Article 48. Mahatma Gandhi had only one request to the Constituent Assembly, please put in ban on cow slaughter. And immediately Ambedkar complied and put it in. And so it is there. So when we say cow must be protected, now we are coming to know that cow's milk is far superior to the milk of all the other cows in the country, in the world. And it has much better the medicinal qualities. In fact, in America now, they have decided to give what is called Bos Indicus. Bos Indicus is the name of Indian cow. I think it must be Greek or Latin, whatever. But Bos Indicus and Bos something else for the others. So these two varieties are there. But Bos Indicus milk is supposed to be the best. And we have so many, many. We have, I think, crores and crores of cows. We don't feed them. We take their milk and then throw them away. They are people, they are cows which should be treated as God, as we treated them as Kamadhenu. So that has to come back, because cow milk is absolutely medicinally the most superior milk that you can possibly have. So here is this this aspect. So cow is there in the constitution. So anybody say, oh, this all this obscurantism, you know, all this, we are all going back to the dark ages. What do you mean you can't kill a cow? Of course you can't kill a cow. Why you can't kill it? It's in the constitution. And you have to obey it. Otherwise, go and try and amend. You can't even amend it, because it's part of the directive principles. That means principles which are being directed to the government to implement. We have fundamental rights. That's a separate matter. But we also have the directive principles of what the constitution directs the government to do. So that's one example. Then uniform civil code, one man, one woman. How can we agree that somebody can marry four women, and then whenever he wanted to marry one more, so he will give talaq to one woman and send her away, and then have the fourth marry the fifth time, but there'll be the fourth wife. So I can't allow that. It has to be one man, one woman. And that is the uniform civil code. The Hindus have it, the Sikhs have it, the Buddhists have it, and the Jains have it. And that is why in the constitution, Article 25, footnote says that as far as the definition of Hindu is concerned, it includes also not only Sanatani Dharmis, but it also includes Buddhism, Sikhism, and Jainism. It's there in the constitution. They are called Hindus, because Hindu is not a religious term. It's people from Himalayas to Hindu Sagar. And that's why some people say he from Himalayas, Hindus, Himalayas has HI in it. So he from that, and Hindu Sagar. So Hindu from Hindu Sagar, and the two together make a Sandhi word of Hindu. So that's how the word Hindu came. But anyway, it's there. In fact, my book will have extracts from Rig Veda, which show that the word Hindu was used. But anyway, Article 44 today says Uniform Civil Code. And it's a directive principle. Government is obliged to implement it. And we have been planning on fooling around, etc. Then we have all religions, without exception, are subject to reasonable restrictions. So if I say you can't do halal to a goat because it's very painful. It's not a humane way to do things. I can always invoke Article 25 and say, no, you can't do that. But we are not doing it because the people get very emotional and all. We'll have to do it someday. We have to respect the, even if you go to eat a goat or any other animal, except of course you can't eat cow, that's banned. But if you have to have some humane view on how it should die. It should die, peacefully, not blood oozing, and that crying, and even cocks and so on. This happens. Now, sooner or later, when we Hinduize the country, this has to come. But it's there in the constitution. I'm not bringing it from some ashram or something like that. So that's another. Third thing is that the word Hindu, I've already explained how it is. But on the other hand, and it, of course, as I said, it is there in the Vedas to describe Hindustan. The Vedas, there are shlokas on it, which I have copied it down and put it in my book. And then you have all Indians are the same. How do I know this? DNA. Some would say, no, South Indians are black and the North Indians are white. So what? That's got nothing to do with race. That's got to do with pigmentation in your skin. If you are away from the hot sun, you are bound to, your skin should be lighter than if you are working in the fields of agriculture near the equator. So therefore, South Indian farmers are bound to have a darker skin than the people who are clerks in North India. So the skin color has got nothing to do with race. It's now all established. What is established is DNA of a person. I don't. So it's a very long thing, but it's there. So that means that according to DNA, we are all the same people. Of course, there are some fringes in the extreme, but those are people we know have migrated much later. But the broad masses of India, 99.9%, they have the same DNA, so they are the same people. And even if somebody came from outside and married here, after ages and ages of marrying within India, that element goes away. Rahul Gandhi had a wife and he had children, then they had children, they had children, they had children. So after about 7-8 generations, they'll all be, their DNA will become all Indian. So the Italian part will just disappear. So there could have been some of these guys who came here, they came as a rapist, they came as a trader, whatever it is. But the broad thing is 99.9% of the Indians have the same DNA. And whether they are Brahmins or they are Shudras or Scheduled Caste or whatever. Scheduled Caste anyway was a temporary category. Unfortunately, it is continued because of foreign invasions. But otherwise, it was nobody's, the Scheduled Caste children were not Scheduled Caste. If they became teachers, they became Brahmins. If they went to army, they became Kshatriyas. If they went to business, they became Vaishyas. And if they went to farming, they became Shudras. So that was the thing. And suddenly there was this swelling up that took place after the foreign invasions came to India. So I would say we are so therefore I'm saying to you that this is another thing that we will insist on modernity. No, make no distinction between any varna of anybody. Jati is different. Jati has got to do with blood, and that's for marriage, because you don't want sisters and brothers to marry. So we have some restrictions, and for that we need to have a blood test. So from that it comes out So there you can have some distinction for that purpose. So then you go into this question that the language which connects all of us is Sanskrit. Now, Karunanidhi didn't like it, but I told him your own name is Karunanidhi, and that is Sanskrit. And you say that your election symbol is Udayan Suryan. That is Sanskrit. Uday and Suryan, both are Sanskrit. And then he said, no, the Sanskrit stole it from Tamil. So, I mean, all right, can have this. But ultimately, I'm telling you, the base of all languages, the percentage of words from all languages is from Sanskrit. And even Tamil has 40% Sanskrit. I'm willing to sit with any expert. I take out a dictionary of the Tamil dictionary, Tamil to Hindi or Tamil to English, and sit down. I'll show you how many words are in common with Sanskrit. So, and when somebody is speaking Tamil, I can stop him and tell this word is Sanskrit, this word is Sanskrit, and so on. So, Sanskrit in Devanagari script, and even that Devanagari script is also very common. Take, for instance, Tamil. If you put ka, you put like this, and which is very similar to in Devanagari. And you want to put ki, you put a matra. In Tamil also, you put over matra. If you want to put ku, you put a matra under. That's also in Devanagari. So Devanagari script should be an additional, optional script to be taught in schools. I'm not saying it make it compulsory because you may not require it. But that that we have to do. So I'm giving you this example, numerals, the same all over. Now we have adopted the international version of numerals, but we gave it to the world. And now we are getting it in a reformed form. And so the numerals are all Sanskrit origin. So Devanagari, the script is the Devanagari. It is the same script. The numbers is the same. And of course, Sanskrit words are there in every language. Some have more. Bengali has, I think, 80%. Malayalam has 70%. Tamil has 40%. You know, like that, you know, it varies from state to state. Now, if you want any constitutional support for this, then go and read Article 31, Article 351, excuse me. And what does it say? It says that the Devanagari script should be the script that should be used for the linked language between India and I'm saying learn two scripts. I've already got learning two scripts. Well, now actually I've learned three scripts. I've learned the Chinese, I've learned British English, and of course Tamil and Hindi. That's four. Four scripts, I have no difficulty. So learning two scripts, your own mother tongue script and Sanskrit script, that will help you, because if in Devanagari you put on the milestones of highways, then you know everybody can read it and understand how many miles or kilometers away it is. Today you have to put it in three languages, four languages. It's ridiculous. You can see even in Delhi there are four languages for the road. If they say Pandara Road, it will be written in four different scripts, which is ridiculous and it's not scientific. So, I'm saying that already we are one, and now this has to be manifested in your mind. And for that, you need a history book, which is correct. And I'm thankful that at last the history book has been ready. I hope quickly it comes through schools. I must finish this because I've taken up a lot of your time. Don't give me very little for interacting. But let me just make one point that I believe that we need to, in order to become a Vishwaguru, which is a Sanskrit word, two Sanskrit words, we must first become what we call as modern right. Modern means all these old matters, you see, should be given up. Some are, you know, for instance, the Indian clothes are good for Indian summer. I'm not saying that you can't wear anything else, but if you're a representative of India, you can't go around looking like a butler or a waiter. That I'm very, very clear. And Morarji Desai's cabinet, nobody had tie and coat. Among the cabinet ministers, Chandrasekhar also himself would be only in dhoti kurta. I'm not saying you must be in dhoti kurta, but you know, if you are a representative of India, you must have Indian clothes. So those are minor matters. I don't think they're a very big issue. But otherwise, we have to be modern. And modern means men and women have to be equal. And we must give them equal opportunity. There were women, if a girl is born in a family, people are crying. If the boy is born, they're all celebrating. That kind of mentality is no more valid. And we must scrap it. We need to do it because India is today, GDP-wise, the third largest. This has got nothing to do with Narendra Modi. All these, then when Modi bucks start telling me, see, he's got third. It was there for quite some time. But that is aggregate value, not per capita. Per capita, we are down 170 or some number like that. But we are growing. We are capable of growing. We were a developed country. And we can become again. So if you want to become a Shuguru, you must have the right model. So market economy, which we have now moved in thanks to Mr. Narasimha Rao and a little to Chandrasekhar also. He also did it. But Narasimha Rao did it wholesale. And today we have a market economy that is have good taxes. In fact, I would like income tax to be completely abolished for at least 20 years. Economy should be made to grow, and we are in a position. We have a large, if you look at the amount, we got 20 million hectares of land, arable land. China is three times our size, but the number of arable land is the same as India. And they, of course, hectare production is much better because they give fertilizer, pesticides, and so on. If we give our farmers the same thing, they will also produce it. The Green Revolution is an example. So I think we have to become an economic power. We have to become a military power. But most of all, we must have a brain which is not brainwashed. It's a brain where you feel a sense of pride that this was the country which was civilized when the whole world was uncivilized. And we produce so many things which the world is today acknowledging slowly. You know that in artificial intelligence, they have discovered that for storing knowledge through vocal methods, Sanskrit is the best script that you can have. And there are schools in England which are now forcing their children to recite Sanskrit slokas. And they performed even for Prince Charles when he was being coronated. This St. James School students, English students, they came and they sang Sanskrit shlokas. And they are all, the West is now beginning to start borrowing. First they borrowed our yoga, then pranayam, and then now they've gone to Sanskrit and they're all learning in Germany. They're learning like crazy. So we must modernize, but not westernize. And that is the way that we have to move forward. India must once again become. Overtaking China is very easy. It may take about 7-8 years if we have the right growth rate. If we can grow at 8-9% per year, or 10% better, then in about 7-8 years, we'll overtake China. Then we are in direct contact with America. American population, young population is getting smaller and smaller as people live longer, but Indians have got a very high proportion of young people. And so educate them properly, make them innovate, and so we can even challenge America. But that's maybe 50 years from now. But nevertheless, we should have this goal and move forward. So these are all going to be in my new book, which will come perhaps in July, called Vishwaguru, Can India Be a Vishwaguru, which is the topic of today's. But in the meantime, I've already given you a copy of the book, which came in 2019 or 18. where I've done the ideology of India's modern right, where in summary I put all the things that we need to do. And this is now published not by Rupa, but is published by Harananda. Harananda has published it. So over to you, Jagdish. You now, all my colleagues can contribute as they see best, and also criticize me if I've gone off the track.
Arvind, you want to start? Your mic, Arvind.
Dr. Swami, a very nice description. But before I ask question, I have a fundamental assumption and just want to verify whether my assumption is right. When you say modern right,
yes,
do we mean modern Hindu? Yes, then I proceed.
No, if any Muslim wants to join in us, I mean, I'm not asking Muslims to give up Islam, not at all. There are many paths to God, and Islam is one of the paths to God. But their cultural mores should not be Arabian. It should be Hindustani. And I do know a lot of Hindu Muslims who are very much Hindustani, and they don't make any fuss about it. And I don't want to also publicize their names. But they are in government, they are in media, they are in all kinds of places. They regard themselves as culturally Hindus. And that's how, that is what, the Buddhists don't mind being called that, and the Sikhs don't mind being called that. You know, so I think the Muslims and Parsis took a vow that they will dress and behave culturally like Hindus, and they have more or less stuck with that. So I think the Hindu is a cultural concept. It's not a religious concept. Sanatan Dharma is a religious concept. I think when I say this, I mean culturally and not religiously.
So Dr. Swami, in the last 70 years of our independence, we have moved with technology, with science and so many different developments. Have we moved away from the traditional India and become modern India? You have mentioned in your book on page 38-39, this book that we are discussing, the idea, the ideology of Indian modern right, that when one examines the core ideals adopted by various institutions, some of the examples as follows. For example, Government of India, the core ideal is Satyameva Jayate. Lok Sabha is Dharma Chakra Pratyavaran Parvartanai, Dharma Chakra Parvartanai. And this is written on the top of the place where the speaker sits. Supreme Court is Yado Dharmasuto Jaya. Where there is a Dharma, there is a Vijay, that is a victory. All India Radio Bahujan Hitai. So like this, you have this mentioned several Indian institutions, including army, which have adopted quotes as motto from Sanskrit literature or Vedas. So in modern times, have we moved away from these, or do we continue with this?
I wouldn't say we have moved away, but I think those with English education have been brainwashed to say that these are all obscurantism, and you know, the world is moving in this, and what is it? I'm not saying don't learn English. Of course, English is a third language necessarily, because it's an international language, not because the British speak English, but the Americans speak English. And because of the Americans and all the research journals, everything being in English, everybody's learning English. So I have no problem with English as a language. But to say that, therefore, you should not learn Sanskrit, that, in my opinion, is a brainless thing. And I'm not asking anyone to compulsorily learn Sanskrit. I'm saying that option should be provided and should learn it. When school children in England and NASA scientists in the United States, they can learn Sanskrit. Why we Indians should not be given the option to learn Sanskrit?
Should I ask another question?
Yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Swami, again, from your book on page 14, you have mentioned about the demographic dividend which India enjoys. India is the youngest country, and I think for maybe another 2-3 decades, we will remain youngest as far as the age, average age of Indian is concerned, Japanese being the oldest. And you've also mentioned, in order to get this advantage, we must educate our youth and develop five types of intelligence.
Yes, correct.
Cognitive, emotional, moral, social, and spiritual. Dr. Swami, the last three that I have mentioned and you have mentioned in your book are a new concept.
Yes.
Though, of course, cognitive and emotional have been discussed for the last about 30 years in organizations and individual development. But these three that you have mentioned, moral, social, and spiritual. So are we doing anything for this? Have you seen government of India doing anything for this?
No. Only spiritual is done in our ashrams. You see, what the spiritual intelligence is, that my mind can connect with the cosmos. And according to our Rishi's belief, all languages, all knowledge, everything is there in the cosmos. And you just need a Wi-Fi connection to it. Your brain must connect with it and you will download all the knowledge. And they say the rishis did that. You know, and today we find out that even this Vimana Shastra volume of Rama's time was there, which told you how to build an aeroplane. And what was the what were they using in place of petrol? They were using mercury. I asked the scientist. He said, yes, but it'll take another, at least another 50, 60 years for us to convert mercury into a fuel. But yes, mercury is accepted now in science as a fuel. But in the Vimana Shastra, it's already there. And they say that the Pushpak Viman flew on mercury fuel, you see. Yes, go ahead.
Dr. Swami,
yes.
Some of our viewers would like to know whether the present government is doing enough to propagate or implement some of these ideas, because the foundation of this government is based on Hindutva and there's a legacy, or people who control the BJP are more or less having these views for past more than half a century, or virtually the RSS is completing 100 years very shortly. So what are your views on this aspect as far as the government which is in power concerned?
You see, they, Mr. Narendra Modi, speaks a lot of Hindi because he does know English. In that sense, I mean, he knows that, he understands English, but he's not fluent in it. So therefore, he is there everywhere speaking Hindi, but that doesn't mean he wants everybody to speak in Hindi. His Hindi also is full of English words, by the way. Just please listen to his speeches. I would say 40% are the English words, which are unnecessary. But I would say that BJP government of Narendra Modi has done less for Hindi than previous governments. What we need to do is Tamil Nadu has to be dealt differently. You just give me two months to fix the Tamil situation. I'll see that they all learn Hindi. The issue is we have been submitting to various people and don't do this, don't do that, etc. But if BJP wanted to do, they should have had free classes for Sanskritized Hindi and compare it to their mother tongue and show how many common words we have in it. And that's the way to motivate them. That we have not done. Even the book on our history, we have all kinds of outrageous rubbish has been put there by the British. It has taken us almost 10 years. And still today, we haven't got a copy that it can be prescribed. We have to now have it subject to some vetting by experts. I think it will take another 5 years if the present trend continues.
Ramesh ji, before we wind up, you have any questions?
Yeah, I just had one question from one of the viewers, Dr. Swami. He says, when do you see India to be renamed officially as Bharat? And when can we see this country as a Hindu Rashtra? So that was from Brajesh Patra. So the viewer question, sir.
Well, I mean, you see, we are already Bharat. When I speak Hindi, I will say India. I will say Bharat. In our speeches, we all in politics, we say Bharat. It's already, those are parts which are easy to do. The what is not so easy to do is to respect the Indianness over, you know, the westernization of dresses, for example, is grossly overdone. And while women have been still fighting to retain wearing saris, but, you know, it's as generations go, it is less and less. I think this inferiority complex is somewhere there which has to go. I am not saying that what is good in the West we should not accept. Of course we should accept. I speak English today because I have no alternative. I can speak in Hindi, but then a large number of Indians will not be able to understand what I'm saying. So the answer to the point is, when do I see that? It will come very fast once the mindset is there. If the mindset is there, the resistance goes away, the politics of it goes away, I'm sure this will be able to do.
Okay. Arvindji, you can conclude.
Okay. Dr. Swami, you have been speaking about the issues related to Hindutva last 40 years in this country. You have written 4 different books. I remember the first book which you wrote was Hindutva and the National Renaissance. Yes. And I had translated that in Hindi also. Hindus Under Siege, you have written, The Way Out. You have written Virat Hindu Identity, Concept and Its Power. And then The Ideology of India's Modern Right, which we are discussing today. In different books on Hinduism, Dr. Swami, you have highlighted the strengths and also weaknesses you have pointed out in Hindutva, which we should all try to overcome. Especially the two issues, casteism and superstitious.
Yes. Yeah.
Andhvishwas or Jatiwad. And many other people who have written on Hindutva has also mentioned this. But the solutions which you have provided, no one has provided. Thank you, Dr. Swami, for taking this cause. There may be many people, Jagdish pointed out to some, who have claimed to be the leader of the Hindutva or the promoter of the Hindutva. But I was approached by an organization in Uttar Pradesh very recently. They have decided to award you the Sanatan Dharma Award, Sanatan Dharma Shiromani Award in Kanpur, actually. And so you are the real Sanatan Shiromani. And thank you very much, Dr. Swami, for taking up this cause. And I'm sure your next book, Vishwaguru, will also take us Indians to a right path, whether government follows or government does not follow. Thank you very much. Thanks, Jagdish Shetty ji. Thank you, Ramesh Swami ji. Thanks, Ashish. Technical team led by Ashish, Gadgi, Rakesh, Ishwar Ayer, Tejas Navalgul, Vishal Mehta, Swaminathan, and Ajesh Nair. We will be taking up the issues like this every Sunday, as you have been told by Mr. Jagdish Shetty earlier. 121 countries, this program is aired, and we have subscribers in 121 countries. Ashish also informed me just before the program that our subscriber list has crossed 110,000. And YouTube has recognized it and given us a symbol of that, a token of that. Thank you very much, viewers, for supporting us. We'll be meeting next Sunday again with Dr. Swami and a new topic at 8 p.m. Indian Standard Time. Till then, Namaskar, Jai Hind.